Welcome to the National Bicycle Greenway's Mountain Mover podcast series. Here you will get up close and personal with people who are taking giant steps for the betterment of cyclists and for the planet itself. We have with us here from his home/bicycle museum in Golden, Colorado, a true living legend, Steve Stevens, who you will soon hear about, shattered the world record for his year 2000 solo crossing of the U.S. on a high wheel bicycle. From the 19th century, his machine not only does not have gears, but he is unable to coast any measure of the ride. Next month, he leaves England, headed for Iran, on his upcoming 3-year journey around the world. So how are you doing today, Steve?
Pretty well, Martin, and you?
I'm doing great. Thanks. Thanks for tuning in on that one. Okay, well, let's talk about Steve Stevens here. Before you did your famous high wheel trip, you rode across the United States with Ram founder Lon Haldeman. What year was that, and how long did that ride take you?
That was 1985. Lon and Sue Notarangelo, his wife, led something called Rappy Tours that year, and it was a 14.5-day ride. It evolved in a couple of years later to a 21-day ride, and I think they still lead it on different routes across country.
14.5 days to go from coast to coast?
Yeah, it early starts in the morning.
Wow. So did you take time off work for that ride that you did with Lon and Sue?
Yeah, it was a couple weeks vacation. I mean, it wasn't anything other than just getting the vacation time.
Great. Okay, you're retired now. What kind of work did you do?
I was at AT&T Bell Telephone Labs for about 35 years. Did a variety of jobs through that time.
Okay. Any kids?
Yeah, I got 2 daughters. And then one of them has given me 2 grandkids.
Wow.
A boy and a girl.
You're a grandpa.
2.5 and a half.
Grandpa Steve, huh?
Yeah.
Wow. What do your daughters think about your high wheel exploits, which we'll get into?
Oh, they put up with my eccentricity, and they've learned to ride, and they don't do a lot. They're at the stage in their careers where they're pretty hectically being driven, mm-hmm. you know, by modern society.
Mm-hmm.
But they kind of, I think, enjoy what I do.
Okay, well, I'm going to use the word bike enthusiast to describe you. How long have you been a bike person?
Yeah, I was a bike person as a young kid, and then got away from it for a little while, although I commuted when I first started working in 1966. But then after 3 years, moved further from work where it wasn't, where the commute wasn't really practical by bike, and so then I was a car commuter. But I got back into riding bikes really in 1979 and 80, motivated primarily by wanting to do the Ironman Triathlon. As a swimmer and a runner, but I wasn't been a cyclist, so I got a bike and started doing cycling again for that.
Great. Okay, and now where was this taking place? In Colorado there?
No, I was living in Illinois at that time.
Illinois. Whereabouts?
Yeah,
near Chicago?
Yeah, western suburbs of Chicago, the Naperville-Lyle area.
Great, okay. How long have you been riding high wheels, Steve?
I saw a high wheel in parade in 1991, actually 2 of them. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I was doing a lot of modern bike riding. That was 6 years after I'd done the Transcontinental on the modern bike with Rappy Tours.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, darn, I'd like to do that. And I did by that point. At the end of the Rappy Tours ride, an abridged version of Thomas Stevens' Around the World on a Bike was given to everybody on the tour, because Lon had written the lead in to it. And so I was aware of Thomas Stevens and his 1884, 1885, 1886 rides earlier. But then when I saw a couple in this parade, I thought, oh, darn, I got to get myself one of those.
Great. All right, so that was the beginning of Steve Stevens' life as a high wheel expert. Do you have any relation to Thomas Stevens?
Oh, I'd love to say I could do that connection. Thomas Stevens came in the late 1870s from England. The interesting thing is that he came from an area about 30 miles away from where my ancestors came. So if you go back, and I haven't traced his family tree back in England, that's one of those things I'd love to do, but I've got too much to do, and so I haven't. But there's a good chance that his ancestors and my ancestors are related 250 years before he came over.
Okay, so I'm going to come back to your initial beginnings as a cyclist, and in particular a high wheel cyclist. Were you an athlete coming into the realm of biking? You say you swam, you ran. Was that something you did as with a high degree of proficiency, or?
When I was a kid, I got on a summer swim team, and I ended up placing in the state high school championships, and then I was a master's champion in Illinois in four events when I was 30.
Okay.
And then I started running, and in 1980 I was doing a marathon every 2 weeks from basically June through November, either marathon or an ultra marathon. It's kind of lucky my joints put up pretty well with that stuff, and went out to New York and had my best marathon that year of a 3:09. Not
wow.
A particularly professional quality, but
uh-huh. At age how old were you at that point?
I was 36 at that point.
Not bad.
I was a recreational runner. I was a noontime go for a run at noon instead of lunch runner.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny. I know my own self that the high wheel cycling I do has pretty much it's obviated my need to be in the gym because I'm working the whole body. Do you find that to be true for yourself as well?
Yeah, I don't go to a gym. I mean, I would like to do a little bit of swimming, but I never. You know, I like being outdoors, and what I found when I took up the bike for the triathlon, I did the Ironman a couple times in Hawaii, and then stopped running and stopped swimming and just biked. And I'd intended just to get the bike to running and swimming,
right,
but it
right.
Switch. Yeah.
And yeah, switching over from your road bike years in the saddle on a regular bicycle, as most people know them. Do you find that riding a high is more challenging physically to your body?
You know, it's yes and no. Actually, the high bike has you in a much better posture. Your back is vertical. Your head's not leaning forward, having to be supported with strain in your neck. So when you ride a high bike, you're in a very good position. Of course, it is not an aerodynamic position. You have more wind resistance. You have more rolling resistance. And I think loosely you use probably 80% more calories per mile going down the road. So it's more work. The other thing, you don't have the benefit of gearing. So when you come to hills, you could be considered to be straining more on a climb. Overall, it's if you're not in a big hurry, it's a far more stately and comfortable ride than a modern bike.
You said 80% more calories?
That's my rough approximation. I do that just by saying what my best times are for doing a century on a high wheel versus a century on a modern bike, basically my modern bike century is at 4 hours and 26 minutes versus about 7.5 hours for an ordinary. I figure, you know, working just about as hard at each one, that's the, you know, my energy output factor in there.
How old are you, Steve?
I'm 61.
Holy criminy. 61, still hammering. I can't believe that. Fantastic. Okay, well, let's talk about Thomas Stevens' 1884 Crossing of America. You rode, you retraced his route from San Francisco to San Francisco and Oakland to Boston to pretty much usher in the millennium. And so when you were done in, from Boston, when you ended in Boston, you came down to our Cycle America 2000 event in Washington, D.C. And from the stage, I announced that you'd set a new world record. How long did that ride take you?
That was to get to Boston from San Francisco, from salt to salt, rear wheel in the salt in San Francisco, and then the front wheel dipped into the bay in Boston. And incidentally, it's the bay that the Boston Tea Party was in, so I may have gotten a little bit of awful drizzle tea on my front tire.
Okay.
But that was 29 days, 9 hours, and 3 minutes.
Phenomenal. Wow. And the previous record was?
It was 33 days, 8 hours. That was by Steve Carter of Plainfield, Illinois, or Plainfield, Indiana.
And how big was your crew on the ride? On that
My brother was driving the support van, and it's really kind of nice if you're trying to move down the road efficiently to have somebody standing there with a water bottle with the Gatorade and Cytomax powders and stuff, holding it out as you come by, and you just grab it and keep going.
You know, out here in Bicycle Land, we hear a lot about your home. This is set up to resemble an 1889 bicycle shop. So how does someone get a tour of your shop, Steve?
It's by appointment. I do a couple open houses, one in winter and one in, which was just actually last week, and then one in the fall. And I usually get 40 to 80 people coming through on a Sunday afternoon.
Wow.
And then I do have some other, you know, small groups call and do it by appointment. But since it's in my house, you know, I have to sort of clean up the house whenever I do it. So I try to get people to come at structured times, because then I don't have
I
to
totally
do
understand
much
that, yeah. So you visited countries all over the world with your high wheel. In fact, you were there when Jack Kester had his famous high-speed crash in New Zealand.
Yep.
Okay. And we've got video of that at bikeroute.com. How many countries would you say you visited with your high wheel steed?
Oh, let's see. It's got to be 20 or 25. I've been in 59 countries, and I've ridden high wheel in Korea, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, England, France, Germany, Czech Republic, Netherlands, East Germany as well as West.
Quite a few.
Yeah.
Okay. Were you in East Germany before the wall came down, or has this been since?
No, that was since.
Okay.
Yeah. I've been in Soviet Union when it was the Soviet Union, not Russia, on a modern bike for a month.
Okay.
Not touring and staying in private homes, but that was before my high wheel days.
Okay. How often then are you on the road in the
present
day?
When I was working, I was on the road an awful lot, and I took the bike with me. I used to be 2 weeks overseas and 2 weeks in the States, and I left the high wheel in the Korea office for a couple years, and I'd be riding on Sundays when I wasn't working in the middle of that 2 weeks. And I left a high wheel down in Melbourne when I was working for a couple years down there. Every 2 weeks I was home and back on that.
Wow.
Then I had one in New Zealand when I was working a couple years down there. Again, on the 2 weeks in Illinois, 2 weeks in New Zealand kind of situation. So,
how long have you been retired?
Now it's been 5 years. I was in high tech, and you know, there was kind of a bust of that whole bubble, and so the older folks are all retired.
Okay. Now, public speaking. Do you do any public speaking at all?
Yeah, I get requests from Kiwanis and different, you know, rotaries and historical societies and museums to put up a little display and talk. And so, yep.
You're ramping up for an around-the-world ride that approximates the route that Thomas Stevens took when he then went on to circumnavigate the globe. You leave in April. Are you doing that ride in stages?
Yeah, Thomas Stevens did 3 years. The first year was 1884 when he went from San Francisco to Boston. Mm-hmm. The second year, he went Liverpool to Tehran, and that was 85. And then 86, after wintering over in Tehran, he continued to Yokohama, although he had wars that he had to work his way around in Afghanistan. But I did the Cross of the U.S. in 2000, and this year I'm doing his route to Tehran from Liverpool. It's taken me quite a while to get the visa approval for that, because currently Iran is not a most favored nation of the U.S. and vice versa. Governments like to get in little tiffs with each other.
So you're pretty much consumed with getting the planning part of that ride. What kinds of things are you working with? You're working with research, figuring out the right roads to travel, the visas you've talked about. Anything else that?
Yeah, I also have to be in shape. So yesterday I rode 118 miles, and 2 days before that I rode 114, and the week before that I had 2 centuries. So that's taken some time being, you know, in condition. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, living in Colorado, the weather's mighty fine, and you can ride all winter. We get storms here, but they go away. But then I'm making sure that the bike's in tip-top shape, and figuring out exactly what to carry and what not to carry and what to send ahead, and having drop points. Munich, hopefully Sofia, then Istanbul, and then the Iran border, where I can have tire replacement and vitamins and Gatorade powder and stuff like that. So I'm getting those packages ready to be sent off. Just a lot of, yeah, the map issue and the GPS. I got a GPS, and I'm trying to, with the Europe software, get the maps. Although they only get you to the Austrian border. So from there on, I don't know of any GPS software that'll give me the detailed map. So using regular maps. I've, of course, reading through Thomas Stevens' book, highlighting every mention of a town and going to the maps and highlighting the towns on the maps to line up with what he did.
Wow. That's a lot involved. How many countries will this involve, going from Tehran to Liverpool?
Starting in Liverpool, England, of course, France, then across Germany through Munich into Austria, and going through Vienna and then to Hungary. And south through Hungary, basically following the Danube, to part of the old Yugoslavia that's Bosnia, and then turn east and leaving the Danube and head up into Bulgaria through Sofia, and then from Sofia head east southeast into European Turkey and Istanbul. And then after crossing the Bosphorus at Istanbul, continuing across Asian Turkey, which is the bulk of Turkey, and then over to the south shoulder of Mount Ararat, which is about 7,000 feet elevation. Makes you wonder how an ark is up there, but that's supposedly where Noah's Ark is. And then enter into Iran at that point and continue in a east-southeasterly direction to Tehran.
Okay, you talked about the fact that you're having your Gatorade and some of these other things, vitamins and such, sent ahead. How are you carrying things? What utility will you be employing to get things, what you do carry, like racks or... Or how is that going to work for you?
I'm going to have a bum bag or fanny pack. I'm going to have a backpack above that on my back, not a monster one. And then on the handlebars, have a little rack that's carrying a miniature tent that I could crawl into and sleeping bag in case I'm caught between towns when it gets dark. And then on the back, behind the saddle on the bike, a MIP bag, M-I-P, stands for Mucho Ben Parvo, Latin for much and little. That's the classical baggage from Victorian times for a high bike.
Okay, so much and little? Was that?
Yeah. Yeah, because
okay.
If you look at the old catalogs, they had these bags. They're about 14 inches tall and 6 to 8 inches wide and 3 or 4 inches thick that just lay down the backbone right behind the saddle. And you can squeeze a lot into them, and so their name with the Victorian... Latin, you know, everybody who was riding bikes was scholarly back then, and so because you couldn't afford to have a bike at a half a year's pay unless you had a pretty good job or your dad did. So they called them by Latin and then abbreviated to MIP.
Okay. My question, I guess, needs to be asked is why are you not carrying anything off the rear axle? It doesn't sound like you have any racks down there or anything like that.
No, that's not where the things were carried in the old days.
Okay, huh. And so you're just more kind of focused on trying to be historically correct. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, also if you do an emergency dismount, you don't want to get hung up on baggage down there. Panniers on the rear wheel are not something that I'm supportive of.
Okay.
You get your foot caught in that and you fall, you don't land on your feet. I mean, if you have a big bulky thing back there and you're getting off fast, it's not very nice.
Okay. Wow. Okay, well, people interested in following your ride can go to crazyguyonabike.com. You pointed that out to me in an email I got from you earlier today. However, I think I want to warn our listeners that you can quite readily get lost there. It's a pretty big touring site. So let me just tell someone, if they go to crazyguyonabike.com, all one word, that what they need to do is go to the upper right-hand corner and use the search to type in the word Steve Stevens and then select reenactment number 2. Is that all sounding correct to you, Steve?
Yeah, and another way from my museum website, The pull-down list at the bottom has a link.
Okay, do you want to give the URL for your museum by web?
Yeah, the way to find it, my museum site's called Golden Oldie Cyclery, and if you go to Google and you just type in Golden space Oldie, spelled O-L-D-Y, Google brings up my site as the first choice.
Okay.
Then the pull-down in that. Now, Google may change. You never know. They've been reliably doing that, because if you misspell a word like Oldie that way, it gets you prime search position.
Okay. So, Golden Oldie, what's the rest again? All one word. Golden
space Oldie, O-L-D-Y.
No, I'm talking about the URL, the actual URL.
The URL is breakfast.org/wheelman/Golden Oldie.
Oh, okay. So it's
that's
much
why
easier.
I say you go to Google.
Okay. Type in Golden Oldie from Google.com, or you can go to bikeroute.com and click on the high wheel section, and you'll be able to get through to Steve Stevens that way as well. Wow, great. Well, Steve, we've reached that point in the interview where we've got to start wrapping up. Is there anything you'd like to add?
Well, I think it's important that everybody understands the significance of the bicycle historically, and not just historically, but the value of the bicycle going forward. And I know that you've been very strong in advocacy of the bicycle as transportation. We're at a point in the world when we're probably halfway through the fossil fuels, the oil, the liquid fossil fuels anyway, and with the whole world expanding and wanting to waste energy as rapidly as Americans have traditionally, and with a historical precedent that oil consumption has doubled every decade, if we're halfway through, that says the next decade could use the last half of the oil that's in the earth. And of course, it's hard to get it out. It's easier to get the first stuff out. It's hard to get the last stuff out. So the bicycle is one of the potential salvations in the future of man's need to propel himself around. It provides self-propulsion, which has benefits from a health standpoint, benefits from an environmental standpoint, many benefits. And so it's not only a child's toy, as it's been thought in this country for the last 80 years, but it's also a very significant future device. And it's kind of nice that all these 8-lane bike paths are being built for 20 years from now.
I like that. That's well articulated.
Yeah, Martin, there's one thing I do want to make sure that I mention, and that is my ride from Liverpool to Tehran is a benefit ride, and it's actually got the donor's choice. Two charities that I find very worthwhile. One is the American Cancer Society. Since I am a melanoma survivor, I can relate to the American Cancer Society focusing on a number of aspects of cancer health, including the research, the support of people who have cancer, the initiatives to try be an advocate to have smoke cessation programs that will reduce the lung cancer. Then the second charity is one called Pennies for Peace. Now, I love the name because the word pennies, like penny farthing, is in it, and for peace. And what this charity does, it's a collecting point that feeds to the Central Asia Institute. The Central Asia Institute is a organization which has built 50 schools in Afghanistan and Pakistan. It was started by a gentleman who was over in that area climbing the large, large mountains, and he almost died. And coming down, he was taken care of in a very poor village. And he noticed that the education was under a tree and scratching stick in the dirt. And he came back and set up a charity. They built 50 schools. And so anyway, on my webpage for the ride, I mentioned this. And these two charities, I think, are extremely worthwhile. So if anybody needs an excuse to do donations, my ride could give them an excuse. A penny a mile would be something in the range of $45 donation to either the American Cancer Society or Pennies for Peace. Like I say, the name Pennies for Peace is kind of nice when you ride the penny farthing.
Great. Now, can you give that website one more time where people can find this Pennies for Peace?
What I have on my around the world page, in the second, there's like three pre-to-riding pages, and I give the discussion there. So on the Crazy Guy on a Bike page, you'll find that reference. I will also on the museum page get a tie-in. It's not there yet.
Great. The museum page is accessed by doing Golden Oldie Oldie Y, going to Google, bringing it up from that.
Yeah.
Great. Okay.
But in the Crazy Guy on a Bike, you know how the format of their things are. You have a page per day kind of thing, mm-hmm. but then there can be preparatory pages, and the second preparatory page talks about it as being a benefit ride.
Great. Okay. All right, Steve. There is one thing I forgot to ask. So, Steve, how many bikes do you have? How many high wheel bikes is what I should be asking you?
Oh, high wheels are about 40.
40 high wheels, and how many of them are functioning?
Oh, most of them are in rideable condition.
Great. Okay. Excellent. And are you going to be taking more than one bike with you?
An unsupported ride. It's hard to carry a high wheel on your back while you're carrying everything else.
Got it. Okay. And which high wheel are you going to be riding on this ride?
The 54-inch Rudge that I rode across the U.S.
The same one. Excellent.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Okay. Now, when I say this is unsupported, I may cheat on that in Iran. There's a fella that I've met through the internet, and he's been helpful in getting me the visa authorization for Iran, which has been a very difficult process. Mm-hmm. And he may be meeting me at the Turkish border with Iran and accompany me. And in Iran, I think it might be useful to have somebody that can speak English, because he's very fluent in English.
Right.
Whereas usually you could get along by body language and things, but Iran may be a case that requires a little bit more of a interface.
Wow. Okay. Okay, so Steve, it's been fantastic talking to you. It really has. And we wish you the absolute best on your ride. We'll try to keep pace with it here at Bike Route. So if you can kind of indeed do forward your journals back to us, that'd be really, really great. We'll get them out to our mailing list. Wish you well, guy.
Thank you, Martin, and good luck with everything that you're doing, furthering the National Bike Greenways.
All right. Okay, Steve, thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That wraps up another edition of the National Bicycle Greenways Mountain Movers podcast series. We hope you enjoyed it. This has been NBG director and Awake Again author Martin Krieg. For more info about the NBG, go to nationalbicyclegreenway.com. To access this podcast in the future and to hear other shakers and movers that we've interviewed, go to bikeroute.com.